Good afternoon. It's Thursday, the 15th of June 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. We're joined today by Patrick Henningsen, 21st Century Wire, and also David Scott from Northern Exposure. And David, of course, as a professional engineer, is going to join us in some discussion about the events around Grenfell Tower. Just horrific, and I think we'll kick straight off with that event.
Yes, Patrick, this is your headline, Grenfell Tower, a Tory wicker man, and the question is, where does responsibility for this lie? And one of the points that you make, we'll talk a bit more about what you're saying here, but one of the points that you make in this article is the cuts to the fire service and so on. So I just want to begin by showing Boris Johnson's attitude while he was Mayor of London to questions about cuts to the fire service, and I believe this was from 2013.
How can cutting fire stations, cutting fire engines, cutting firefighters' posts not be a reduction in fire cover?
Because we're improving fire cover, as I've said several times, and it by continuing to reduce deaths from fire and continuing to reduce the incidence of fire. That is the name of the game.
You've lied to the people of London in your
election. Get stuffed.
So, oh, get stuffed is Boris Johnson's attitude whenever questions are asked about cuts to the fire service. What are your thoughts, Patrick, on your coverage of this in that article and particularly about that point and Johnson's attitude to it?
There's a number of items that you can line up here that certainly could be viewed as feeding into a situation that led to the fire that we had yesterday. So cuts in the fire service or any emergency services, of course, can be blamed for maybe lack of response. But there's other things as well. There was a piece of reform legislation to a bill tabled by Labour, which was struck down and sidelined by a group of 72 conservative MPs who just happened to also be commercial landlords. And this was some sort of guarantees to make all of the accommodations habitable, in quotes. So there's that too. So I guess it just so happens that two of these things stick mainly to the Tory party, that you could relate to this incident. But it goes even deeper than that. Just to not let the Conservatives have all the glory on this story, we can go right back to New Labour, and who Margaret Thatcher said is one of her greatest achievements. Tony Blair and New Labour, under this government, ramped up this part private, part public management schemes for councils to manage large groups of council flats in what they call the TMO system, or tenant management organizations. But when you speak to the tenants of these buildings, they don't have any say in the management of these buildings. The TMO is only a name. It's only a name that it's a tenant management organization. What it is, it seems to me, by many of the reports we've read, which we've linked to in this article, that the TMO seems to be a vehicle for handing out sweetheart contracts to well-connected people and also paying very handsome fees and salaries to the executives lucky enough to sit on the board. And in Kensington and Chelsea, we've reported in the past about how residents were intimidated. One gentleman who I think you played on after your news program yesterday, who while he was in for a heart condition, they boarded up his flat and used all sorts of methods to get out people that the undesirable tenants, as it were, and then possibly put those properties on the rotation for selling off into the private sector. And so it's just a long litany of things, a number of scandals, threatening legal action against residents who dare to blow the whistle on any of this stuff. This is all stuff that's detailed in this article, which I encourage people to go read and click through the links.
Yeah, indeed. And when you were speaking to those people, I think we made that documentary in 2011, Patrick, if I'm right, or 2012. And it was the same tenant management organisation, as we said, but they were discussing much broader problems at that time.
Yeah, that was Kensington and Chelsea TMO, the exact same organization. And when we confronted the management, brought a camera into the office to speak to them with the gentleman with the heart condition, they didn't want to be filmed and didn't want to speak to anybody. That was all on camera. You can watch it on that special of Insight from 2012. But that was just one of many stories we heard. As soon as that documentary came out, we were contacted by many other residents as well. And as you can see from the article, and also just from the coverage, even from the BBC and talking to residents out in the streets, so many people have so much to say about the mismanagement of these large properties of primarily low-income residents.
Yeah.
I find that little clip very, very interesting, because of course so many are lured into this sense that Boris Johnson is just some jovial, bumbling idiot. But what you got there was a glimpse into what the real Boris Johnson is, what he's capable of. He takes the professional expertise, collective expertise of the fire service people who were in front of them, and he's just rude to them in a despicable fashion. And this is the characteristic, of course, of this man that we would have if we were stupid enough to allow him to ever get near the post of Prime Minister. So I think there's a big lesson in that clip, and it's not just about fire safety.
Well, let's bring David Scott in at this point, because David, you are professionally a structural engineer. So let's run through some of the information that we know so far.
Just before we start on the technical, we just say a wee word about the fire service. The clip from Boris Johnson was very interesting, as much for what he didn't say, because there has been a huge reduction in fire incidents in the UK. Since 1999 to the present day, it's roughly halved. So it's not necessarily unreasonable that if you have half the number of call-outs from the fire service, you might need fewer stations or people. But of course, what matters here is response time and the ability to deal with incidents when they do come up. So it was a very ignorant response from Boris Johnson there. And we're seeing similar ignorant attempts to use this for political capital from the Labour Party just now. Because remember, the fire service were there in 6 minutes. So it doesn't seem to have been a response time issue. And they seem to be pretty well resourced. The problem here is somewhere else. But I would simply point out that in looking at the fire service, the driving impetus must be to get the right people at the right time where they're needed. Not necessarily any given set staff or establishment.
That's right, David. But of course, if you close fire stations, you don't have the personnel, as you say, close by. If you have an incident of a certain scale, which this was, this incident was unprecedented because we haven't seen this type of fire in this country before. If you don't have the personnel available because of cuts or for whatever reason, then you can't deal with incidents of this scale when they happen. So are the deaths then just an acceptable level of risk? Is that what we're talking about?
Well, obviously that shouldn't be what we're talking about. But what my point is that if you're having half the number of incidents, and the reason for this, incidentally, is nothing to do really with the fire service or indeed with the population, other than we're smoking less. Habits have changed, and oven chips have made a huge difference because people don't have chip pan fires anymore because they have oven chips. And furniture is less flammable. So these things have made a huge impact in the number of fires we're having, which is excellent. So the fires have halved. So there must be some response to that. But the response must be an intelligent one that maintains the ability to deal with major incidents, not one that's driven simply by money saving or by some sort of crude approach where half the number of fires equals half the number of firefighters, which would be nonsensical.
David, just to reinforce you on that, we had the situation here in Plymouth and the surrounding area. that the limitation at one stage for the fire service was that they didn't have a high-rise ladder available. So obviously this is one of the vehicles with an extremely high capability for the ladder. And the government solution was that, well, OK, you can share that facility in the region, which meant, of course, if there was a serious fire in a high-rise building, even if you could get the fire tenders there, they couldn't fully act on the fire because they didn't have this extended ladder capability. Now, I'm not sure how that got resolved, but I know that a few years ago, this was a very, very hot discussion point between the local fire service, who were trying to do their job, and a government that was making what can only be described as stupid and ridiculous cuts.
Let's move on to this then. So, David, take us through this. The work happened a year ago, was it?
Yes. Yeah, so Grenfell Tower, designed 1968, built 1974, it was complete. It's a concrete building. It's not clear to me whether it was built in situ concrete or precast large panel systems, which affects the robustness of the structure. So built in the at the peak of the high-rise building boom, early 70s, and designed before but built after Ronan Point, the famous progressive collapse of a large panel system building.
And this is the company that did the work, is that right? Yes, it is, yeah.
Yes, so the work was completed in summer last year, an £7.8 million pound refurbishment, which was inside and out, so we had new services. You see here the very plush gym, very nice looking building, and it was overclad to improve its appearance, its durability on its external surface.
Right, so we have the sun insulation here, showing before and after pictures to show yes, how the refurbishment looked.
So the outer cladding you see here is a flat panel in aluminium, a very attractive architectural product that transformed the building's appearance from somewhat sad and unloved 1970s tower block to something much more 21st century in appearance. This material is one we're going to concentrate on today. So the overcladding system is as follows. There's an insulation board applied directly to the original outside surface of the building. This is PIR, polyisocyanurate foam, and a bit more on that later. So that was 100 millimetres of that foam. There's then a 50 millimetre cavity, and then there's this outer cladding, which is only 6 millimetres thick. And it's a composite board, and it comprises two layers, an inner and outer layer of very thin aluminium, half millimetre aluminium, and a core of low-density polyethylene, so polythene core. And that's the area that we should be concentrating on in terms of what went wrong here, what went so tragically wrong. The Herald here has a description of the material, and it's identified the product correctly, as I understand it. And so what I want to talk about is how we've got to this situation and what these materials are actually like. There are regulations and there's good industry guidance governing how tall buildings are overclad. The risk of fire spreading up the outer cladding has been well recognised for some time. There have been worldwide several very major incidents. So what you see on screen here is the guidance document for Celotex RS5000. This is a PIR insulation that was applied to the outside of the building. And the little diagram you see there is taken from the industry standard guidance document on this subject. And it illustrates exactly the problem that happened here. It illustrates that either you have an outer cladding that is resistant to fire and only burns very slowly. So as a fire in a flat reaches what's termed flashover, now that's a point where the atmosphere inside the compartment where the fire is gets so hot that everything combusts. So the temperature rises and rises and rises, gets to a point where everything in the room catches fire. and then the temperature then peaks. It's called flashover, so you get a very rapid temperature rise. This destroys things like windows, and the fire breaks out to the outside. Now, one of two things happen, and they're illustrated in this diagram. Either that then slowly works its way up the building, gets in through a window on the floor above, sets light to the contents in the flat above, which they then have to slowly burn, reach this flashover point, and then the process is repeated. So the fire progresses very slowly up the building. On the other hand, if the fire can spread up the cladding, then all floors right to the top of the building are immediately affected by secondary fire, and the whole building's engulfed very rapidly, which is exactly what happened here.
And the point the point that you're making here is that this is a well-recognized problem.
The risk was known, was correctly identified. People knew exactly what we were trying to avoid. Right? This was not a surprise that this could happen. Now, the material PIR was tested. Now, a little bit about the test. This next slide illustrates the nature of the wall construction that was tested, which is different from the nature of the wall construction that was built. Now, what the test involves is a section of wall being built with an aperture in it representing a window, and a basket with a great deal of timber is placed in that, and the thing's set alight. And it's allowed to burn for half an hour. And then the burning timber is removed. So this represents a fire breaking out through a window and setting light to the cladding, affecting the cladding roundabout. So the window is modelled in this test. It's half an hour of a very intense fire, and then the combustion source is removed, and the test is continued for another half hour to see how the cladding, how the fire progresses in the cladding. And a successful test is that the fire does not get to the top of the test panel, which is 6 meters high, in 1 hour. So that's the standard. The fire should spread no more than 6 meters in 1 hour. Now, in minutes, this fire spread to the very top of the building. So something very different from the test performance has actually happened here.
When I looked at the documents that you sent me, David, there was a statement in it which suggested that this type of cladding shouldn't be used on buildings over a certain height. Is that correct?
Well, this relates to the PIR insulation foam. Most PIR insulation foam isn't suitable for buildings over 18 metres, and this is due to its fire performance. This particular PIR foam was allowed to be used in much taller buildings because it had satisfied this test. Now, the test was run with the foam insulation that was used on the building and a different outer cladding, a glass-reinforced plastic, which is a solid board and much more durable. So the cladding had been changed on the outer for architectural reasons. The cladding had been changed, but the test was still considered valid. And the reason that the test was still considered valid was that the classification of the outer cladding was the same as class O, which is a measure of how flame spreads across the surface. So that's one thing I'd like to come back to, is just what these tests actually measure, because they measure certain specific things. So we had a successful test on the PIR foam with a cladding material that showed that the flame wouldn't propagate rapidly on the building. And on the basis of that test, this system was authorised. The actual outer cladding was changed from one material to another, but they had the same official rating in terms of surface spread of flame. So nobody thought, the regulators, the designers, the contractor, thought they were operating within known areas that were covered by testing. But they weren't, for a reason which I'll try and pin down now. This surface spread of flame test it tests the paint on the cladding, essentially. It only tests the surface. It's there to make sure that fire can't propagate rapidly across a surface and cause rapid spread from one area to another. but it's a small flame source. It's held on the material for 1 minute. So it's very small, small amounts of heat, 1 minute. And then it's removed and the test is observed for another 10 minutes. And the distance that the charring and flame spreads out from the point at which the flame's applied will determine the rating. So the further the flame spreads, the poorer the rating. So this was Class O, which is the best standard, which means that the paint and the aluminium, the thin aluminium facing on this panel, wasn't allowing flame to spread, which is what you want. But nothing of that tested the core. So you get a big fire, nothing like the test, a big fire breaking out of a window affecting this cladding, and it gets to the polyethylene, polythene core of this cladding. And then that, that's flammable, that melts. Now, I don't know if you've got the little video I sent through of, no, you haven't, no. But there is a YouTube video which shows a simple test showing polyethylene being set alight. And it drips, it's like it's fire rain, they describe it as. It drips, it melts, it burns very clean. They say it's chemically similar to candle wax. It burns in a relatively clean flame, but it drips and it melts at very low temperatures. So this is the core of the cladding material. Now, what you then have is an ability for the cladding to allow the fire to propagate very rapidly up the building. There are fire stops which are meant to block off the cavity so that any fire getting into the cavity can't propagate up the building. But because this would be propagated in the outer cladding, it would bypass all of that, so all of the fire stops would be ineffective, and the fire would propagate very rapidly up the building. Then what you had was this very large fire was the inner insulation material, the PIR foam, which is quite a durable material. If you had a piece of this and you put a blowtorch on it, it would char and some smoke would come off. And if you take the blowtorch off, the fire would immediately extinguish itself. You know, so it's a relative, if you test a small piece, it looks very benign. When it's tested in large fires, it produces, at relatively low temperatures, a couple hundred degrees, huge quantities of very toxic black smoke.
Yeah.
And smoke is, of course, the killer. So it was a combination of the outer cladding being changed and the inner insulation providing a source for this black smoke that made the situation so very deadly.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you for that, David. Now, let's look at some of the coverage on the BBC, particularly of this. And first of all, we're going to look at a short excerpt where she was discussing the residents committee's website and the comments that were made in the past about that, and we'll look and see how this lady is treated.
Just explain to us what you meant by that piece. Well,
Ed, the guy who wrote that piece, was very, very aware, not professional, but it was obvious that the standard of works was really, really shoddy and really, really poor. Boilers in front of the front doors. Pipework sticking out inches outside of the walls. There were power surges that weren't looked into, where the lights in the building went dead, and the fire, the emergency lighting, didn't come on. And these residents asked again and again and again, and they were threatened with legal action when they said that they wanted this work to take place. You know, and you've got a cost-cutting council that isn't listening to its residents. It's a privatised organisation. And you've got a big building company, Ryden, that is getting a lot of money from a lot of contracts across London and doing shoddy work. And it's not just here, it's in other parts of London as well. It's very distressing. And like you said, this is a very unequal area. These are poor residents, or they're ordinary residents. They're not the wealthy, they're not the Camerons. They can't afford private schools, they can't afford lawyers. They tried to get lawyers, but because of the legal aid cuts, they couldn't get lawyers.
So Patrick, there we have a journalist from the BBC really attempting to get in at every opportunity, every point that local was talking, every point that the local was making, the BBC trying to jump in.
No, it's amazing that they pull residents to want to talk to this sort of man or woman on the street, and then the news reporter or presenter or whatever they are spends the whole segment trying to interrupt them and cut them off from what they're trying to tell the camera, the news program. It's extraordinary. But I think that's par for the course. I think that's a BBC style of on-the-street reporting. Maybe they didn't like what was being said by the resident. Maybe it was too raw and too honest and too revealing, perhaps. Otherwise, why would she be trying to interrupt her every few seconds? It was the most bizarre scene, but I'm hardly surprised, actually.
Well, actually, let's see another clip, because exactly the same thing happens.
One thing I wanted to say, though, this thing that they're all saying about, oh, it might have been a fridge that exploded or something like that. I don't know about all of that, but what I do know is they did regeneration last year to that building that they're talking about doing to all of these buildings. They did it to that building only, £10 million they're talking about, and put these shoddy plastic things on there that set up a light because they want more reasons to knock these blocks down. There's two options. They could either regenerate the blocks or they could knock them down. And after that, I'm not so sure that was totally an accident. I'm not even going to lie. Like, I'm not even going to lie to you. You could pause me there, but I'm not going to lie. The whole situation that's going on in this area, the way that they don't want us here, and they put those rich man's blocks over there, and then they tell certain man in Frinstead they can't even go into that section, that's outrageous. I can't lie. The way that they treat man in here is terrible, isn't it? So I can't even take the belief out of my mind that wasn't just an accident. Do you know what I'm saying? I'm not going to lie. I think it's fucked. And I think...
But we don't know. We don't know.
But you're talking about the regeneration that happened last year to apparently make these blocks better. And then these fires have never happened. I've lived here my entire life. My mom's lived here a very long time. And these kind of things have never, ever happened in this area. Like, okay. I don't know what they spent £10 million on. But the lifts in this block and all the blocks around, they only cost £60,000 to fix, and they still never replaced them throughout the time I've lived here. So £10 million for that? No, they didn't. No. Okay. I'm not really fucking with the government right now. That's all I'm saying.
I'm going to apologise for your language.
So again, Patrick interruptions, and at the end of it, she felt the need to apologise for the language. This is a local guy that has witnessed some pretty horrendous scenes. I think his language is understandable.
Yeah, well, what he's describing there is exactly what happened. There was, I guess, regeneration money earmarked for that one particular building. I think there was spent $11 million was allocated to that. Most of that goes to the contractor that was awarded the job, and then the rest seems to have been shared out in fees and salaries and whatnot with the TMO. But yeah, he's telling it exactly as he saw it. And then again, the BBC reporter there trying to manage the conversation. She did try to interrupt him a few times right at the beginning of the segment, and he pushed through and got a chance to say what he wanted to say. But then she's again trying to play gatekeeper and telling him what to think, like, well, you don't know that, and so forth. So, I mean, it doesn't get any more raw than that on the street, and you do want to hear what people are thinking and saying on the street. I don't see what's wrong with that from a journalistic point of view, but for some reason, the BBC reporters are constantly intervening with their subjects, trying to get them to stop or, qualify what they're saying or steer the conversation. It's incredible.
Well, let's look at regeneration then, Brian.
Well, I think we should. And I'll say straight off that those two clips I found extremely emotional, because that wonderful woman knew her stuff. What was she saying? She said that the authorities didn't want to listen to ordinary people. They were too busy organising their contracts. And then the young man is saying there's something going on. These regeneration programs, they don't want us. And where does this take me? Well, it takes me right back to the beginning of the UK column, where we were looking at this sort of happening, this sort of event in Plymouth. And let's take you through some of the background. What you've got to get into is the New Deal for Communities initiative. This was part of New Labour, 1999 to 2008. 39 New Deal for Community project areas, 6,900 projects, and equip £1.71 billion. I've said there, this destroyed traditional Britain, and this is exactly what it was designed to do. You can find this report on the internet if you Google it. This is the final report on the so-called success of the New Deals programme. But of course, there were lots and lots of problems, and many people saying this was a new brutal socio-economic initiative brought in by New Labour. And I can say, Mike, that certainly in the Plymouth Southwest area, the BBC absolutely refused to report all of the dangers, the bullying, the fraud and corruption that came in on the back of this programme. You can freeze the screen to have a look at the detail there, but look at the language. This is about transforming 39 areas over 10 years by achieving holistic change. This is a heavily politicised programme. It's nothing to do with improving people's lives. As that young man correctly ascertained, this is about social engineering. Now, I've just picked one man here. I'm not saying that this man is at fault. What I'm highlighting is that when you get into New Deal, what do you find? You find universities, and this man, of course, also involved with the Tavistock Institute. So we're into deep applied psychology and social engineering. Let's see how this thing works. So bring in the New Deals programme, all about regeneration, 39 partnerships and those 6,900 projects. They supposedly were looking at crime, community housing and the physical environment, education, health and worklessness. Very interesting word, because that was the first time I ever saw that rather strange word. That was in documentation appearing here in Plymouth.
And how is that different from unemployment?
Well, this is newspeak. This is transformational newspeak, Mike. So the key bit is it all worked in partnerships. And what this did is broke down separation of powers, responsibility and accountability. And this is the very meat that we're seeing in this terrible fire accident, that we've got the local authority linked into a private company which has taken over that association. This is a deliberate mess where all of these organisations will work to cover each other's backs because they're all culpable within the partnership. Now, this is what the government had done. It had set up the offices for the regions, the government offices for the regions. This is when New Labour thought it was going to be able to implement the European style of government via the regions. And these regional offices held great power with the administration of the New Deal money. They were supported by the development agencies, and some of these regional development agencies were involved blatantly in fraud and corruption as they did deals with the money on the back of this funding that went in. So if we have a look at the funding, this is the fuel of corruption, and the New Deal programme spread corruption everywhere, down to the lowest levels as people started to feed. But of course, the European Union brought in a lot of the money, and with it came European Union political control. Then we had the government money, and of course, that was fueling the corruption. So local authorities simply became mesmerised by the money, and when they took the European money, they became dependent on EU cash and the controlling EU political agenda. And I'll come on to that a bit more in a moment. But what was the meat of these New Deal projects? They were regeneration programmes demolishing the historic British urban infrastructure to create these uniform city centres. They divided city areas into rich, poor economic zones. This is very Orwellian. And local people were manipulated by so-called regeneration companies in order to get this wider political agenda in. So everything is there on that diagram for you. We had enormous experience of this in Plymouth, including the fraud and corruption and the missing money. But the other thing that came in with it was common purpose. And here we've got Julia Middleton, Chief Executive of Common Purpose, sat in one of these terrible regenerated city centres. Here's the brick paviours. They brought in a lot of stainless steel, different street furniture. And then we started to get these uniform EU regulated city facades, depressing desert. What they were doing is wiping out everything to do with UK culture. And this is just amazing. This is Devonport Column, the start of UK Column. It's edition 3 from 2006. And what we were warning about was a very brutal agenda in Devonport in Plymouth, where local people that had worked in their community for a long time were bulldozed out of the way by these regeneration organisations. And when people complained, the police were brought into guard meetings.
When was that, 2006 or so?
2006. Yeah. And on this one here, you can see that we actually mention NDC, New Deal for Community, and we were also highlighting that money was going missing through the so-called regeneration company. I'll just bring on to the last page here. We'd got every part of this jigsaw because we were warning that Plymouth City Council, supposedly short of money, had spent £100,000 on common purpose training. It's all here. And where was the money going? Well, 320 million of this sort of New Deal money disappeared in Cornwall. No accounts have ever been seen. This is the European money, examples of it coming in, European Regional Development Fund, the European Social Fund. This was to bribe and control people. And a lot of it mixed into so-called other agendas. Here we've got convergence for, quote, economic transformation. And if you do your research, here's the Treasury involved with a thing called Total Place. This was setting a new direction for local public services. So it wasn't only regeneration on the ground. They got in amongst public services to change, transform, destabilise them. And there were 30 pilots selected for this across the country. And if you're wondering, where does this agenda come from? Well, I'm going to recommend you have a look at work of this man, Peter Drucker, because Peter Drucker said that if you want to change society, if you want to change world society, then you've got to connect the state, you've got to connect churches, you've got to look at the social thing. You've got to bring all of these together, his so-called three-legged stool. And what we're looking at here is communitarianism. And where does that take us? Well, you've been talking about this for many weeks, Mike. This is the rise of the so-called city states, and they are going to be the new environment that we live in.
Yes, I think we'll probably... first of all, Patrick and David, have you got any thoughts on what Brian's just presented here?
I just wanted to just say City Con of London demanded a full and independent inquiry, and breaking news, Theresa May just confirmed a few minutes ago that there will be a full and independent inquiry into the Grenfell Tower inferno. And so this is Shadow Housing Secretary John Healey putting pressure on the government that the recommendations from Lacanal House Flats in Camberwell, that fire in 2009, that was put in motion within a month of the event, and they're asking the exact same process take place here this summer before Parliament goes on vacation in August.
Okay.
Patrick, I'll just interject there, if I may, and say my prediction today is that will be an absolute cover-up, because if you look at the way this new city structure works, because these people are all working in partnership, they are all going to defend each other. If any one of them goes down from the local authority or the housing association, any one of them goes down, they're going to take the rest of them with them. So you will see very clever, very calculated cover up to produce a report that will say, well, we did make some mistakes. We'll do better in the future. Few people died. Let's move on. I guarantee that's how they will try and drive it.
David, any thoughts?
And the terms of reference of this inquiry will be quite narrow. They won't look at the changes in local government. They won't look at the funding. The political parties will line up and look to take advantage or avoid the opposition taking advantage of the death toll and of the horrible images that have come out, and the big issues, the issues that you were outlining there, Brian, I would predict that they would not even be touched.
Of course, and yet that socio-political economic agenda is the agenda that has actually driven this state of affairs. And I'm going to stress that when you brought in common purpose, when you bring in common purpose, this is where this vicious, aggressive dismissal of the views and values of ordinary people come in. This is where local authorities treat local people as if they are dirt. And clearly in this case, ordinary people from that tower block warning and warning and warning that something was wrong. What happens? Not only are they dismissed, but the local council spends taxpayers' money on legal teams to try and shut them up. Same thing happened in Plymouth, and I can say that the same ruthless agenda was unleashed in all the cities that undertook the New Deal for Community agenda, whether it was up in Glasgow or if it was Liverpool or Sheffield. Wherever that agenda came in, with it came a very, very aggressive change in the way that local authority and people in the public sector treated the ordinary man and woman in the street.
Because the term that's used quite often for this process is gentrification, which sounds soft and cuddly. It's
yes.
Nothing of the kind.
Nothing of the kind. And of course, one of the things that has happened on the back of the regeneration is that private companies have made millions, because as ordinary people have been displaced from their homes, they might have been slightly rundown homes, but the local councils have displaced local people, brought in the gentrification, but that has also allowed housing and regeneration companies to make millions on the back of suffering of ordinary people. This is a very dangerous, serious agenda. And the thing to remember is this is not from Labour. It has been continued via the Conservatives and the Lib Dem alliance. So this is a cross-party agenda. It needs to be stopped. If we get Boris Johnson as Prime Minister, he's already shown us what he's capable of, which is being rude to the very fire services people who were trying to warn him of what was coming.
We'll just mention this and end on this, because, of course, with the fact that Theresa May has formed a minority government and her discussions with the DUP to try to create some kind of agreement to form a coalition. Parliament, although it's, the MPs are re-elected, it's not formally sitting until the Queen's speech. The date of that has now been announced. Andrea Leadsom this morning, she is the leader of the House of Commons, said the government has agreed with Buckingham Palace that the state opening of Parliament will take place on the 21st of June 2017, which is next Wednesday. That had to be agreed with Buckingham Palace because next week Brian is Ascot. And as we know, the Queen doesn't like this hat quite so much because she absolutely prefers this hat and the cart and so on. And next Thursday is the Gold Cup and she absolutely can't miss that. And so if it doesn't happen on Wednesday, it would be delayed till the following week.
People may think we're joking in making this report, and we're absolutely not. It's quite clear that the horses are the important agenda.
Absolutely. Now, Ian Crane, when he was here last Friday, said that he wouldn't be doing any programmes this week. But in fact, that situation has now changed. And tonight at 7:30 p.m., on the live stream, Humanity versus Insanity and a 2100 fracking nightmare, as usual. So he will be here this week after all.
Excellent.
We'll leave it there.
I think we will. David, thank you very much for joining us. Patrick as well. Really terrible events unfolding in UK, but we're going to say to people, please, with those events, do not take your eye off what is happening in Westminster, because the LibLab con is now really starting to come into its own. This is the time for well-informed people to get out there and challenge these politicians and start to bring them to account. But do not take your eye off the ball with what's happening in Europe. And of course, a key issue continues to be the loss of Britain's military into the EU military unification. If we lose the military, this country does not exist as a nation state. And this is what is happening despite the lies of Theresa May and her Conservative colleagues. We'll be having a little bit more on that in the news tomorrow. Thanks very much for joining us. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.